after yesterday's shooting at the GOP baseball practice outside of Washington, we ask, where do we go from here?
If we don't bring the dialogue, the political dialogue in this country down a few notches to a reasonable exchange of views and debate and compromise, shame on us.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. We speak with him and former longtime politician and Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. We'll also discuss how technology and social media play into the political divisions in our society. Also, two court hearings taking place this week could shape the future of Illinois' budget impasse. We'll get the latest from IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey. Finally, which plants could be toxic to your pets?
It's the nature of the beast. You know, a Labrador is going to eat anything. Cats are much more finicky.
Illinois toxicologist Michael Beal joins us to talk about what pet owners need to know about keeping their animals safe. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, we're talking about where we go from here. That's after the events of just 24 hours ago when a gunman opened fire outside of Washington at a GOP practice for the annual bipartisan congressional baseball game. From Illinois' congressional delegation, Representative Rodney Davis was up at bat when the shooting started. He was able to make it to safety. Congressman John Shimkus and Darren LaHood were both on the team but weren't at the practice. The alleged shooter was also from Illinois, from Belleville. James Hodgkinson's Facebook page had displays of anger and venom towards President Trump and the Republican Party. He had volunteered for Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign for president. Yesterday, Senator Sanders was clear in condemning the shooting. All of this, the way that politicians and citizens have reacted to the shooting, is what we're talking about today. Are we at a moment, as Representative Davis said yesterday, that is a breaking point and should be a turning point for this country? Are we so divided and so angry that this should be the time when we say, what's going on? We're going to be talking about that today with politicians, both current and former, a political scientist, and with you, our listeners. We've been asking you on social media where we go from here. Elizabeth on Facebook says she suspects politicians have always, quote, misrepresented facts. Now, though, she says we're better able to fact check and, quote, people are upset that they're being lied to wholesale. Elizabeth says, I think it would help if politicians spoke not from party line loyalty, but from facts about what would help the majority of their constituents. We want to hear from you. Just like Elizabeth, what do you think? You can join our conversation. You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet to 21st Show. Our handle, again, is 21STShow, or you can give us a call. 1-800-222-9455. Our number again, 1-800-222-9455. Members of both sides of the aisle have been sending messages of support and have called for civility in this heated political climate, including Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin. I spoke with him earlier this morning. Senator, welcome back to the 21st.
Sure.
You know, Senator Durbin, yesterday your colleague in the Illinois congressional delegation, Representative Rodney Davis, called the shooting at the baseball practice a breaking point for him. And I wonder, you're someone, you've been in political office for several decades. Do you see yesterday as a reflection of America's political landscape and division, or do you think that's overstating things?
Well, I think what happened yesterday, an act of violence against my colleagues in the House of Representatives, really did lead to some soul-searching by many of us about the current state of affairs and politics in America. The language has become coarser and more violent and more confrontational. We are now looking the other way when extreme voices on the right and on the left say and do things which once was considered unacceptable. And I guess, particularly for Congressman Davis, who was at that baseball field yesterday, it was a moment of finally awakening, a realization that if we don't do something about it as the current generation of politicians, it's only going to get worse.
When we think about the fact that the apparent shooter was from Illinois, we don't know yet a motive, but based on social media and interviews, we know that he was fervently and vocally anti-Republican. And I can't help but think what I just heard on Morning Edition, one of his neighbors say this morning that he was angry. He was angry not just at Washington, but this neighbor said about how Illinois lawmakers are getting a paycheck and not doing their job. And certainly, I think most people obviously are angry, that doesn't mean that they're going to pick up a gun and start shooting people. There has to be a mental health component to this. But I wonder what you think about the fact that maybe people are very angry here, and that does get amplified by, as you're saying, these extreme voices on the right and left.
Well, I can tell you, this man, whom I don't believe I had ever met, the shooter yesterday, had been corresponding with my office for 8 years. And so we gathered together 16 different emails that he sent and read through them, turned them over to law enforcement first, but then read through them and looked for any warning signs in there. And there were virtually none. They were routine emails about the issues of the day before Congress. The closest he got to any message to us was being critical of Betsy DeVos, the new Secretary of Education, who justified guns in the classrooms to protect against grizzly bears. I'm not making that up. She said that was one of the circumstances. Well, he wrote and said he disagreed with that position. The point I'm getting to is, here is a man for 8 years who expresses himself to me in private emails and never once crosses a line where I would say, wait a minute, I want to take a look at this man. I want to turn this over to somebody. So the fact that people are politically involved, the fact that they may even be emotional about political involvement, does not in itself explain crossing that divide into violent and deadly conduct. I'm not a psychologist, nor do I have any expertise in this, but it clearly there's more to the story as to why he camped out in Alexandria and waited for that moment.
Right. And so those emails, as you said, you all went through those. As you said, nothing in those emails that would ever suggest something like yesterday.
No. Violence, never. Clearly a man who wrote on to me on so many different issues that some way or another he was following what was happening. My guess is, now that I've read about him, is that he was repeating or forwarding emails that he received from some other source. There was just too much detail in his request. There's nothing in his background or education to reflect that he was that conversant with issues.
We have news today that President Trump is also under investigation now by special counsel Robert Mueller for obstruction of justice, according to the Washington Post. I wanted to ask what your reaction to that is.
Inevitable. This president has, by his own words, raised this investigation. You know, when he contradicts the first explanation for firing the director of the FBI and says to Lester Holt of NBC on national news, no, it really wasn't about Hillary Clinton. I just wanted to stop this Russian investigation. And then goes on in detail with his tweets and his public statements to confirm these things which he has said and done. It was inevitable that this would be investigated. How it will end, I can't say. But I'll tell you this, Bob Mueller, the special counsel, is a real professional. He's smart. He's principled. He's been a federal judge, head of the FBI. He's a Republican. He was in the Marine Corps during Vietnam. And he'll put country first. I trust him, whatever his conclusion may be.
Do you trust Attorney General Jeff Sessions? I think yesterday's shooting has somewhat, almost forgotten that testimony was Tuesday, 2 days ago. And I know you put out a statement that said, in part, you don't see how he can continue to serve as Attorney General.
I don't get this. If you're an Attorney General of the United States of America, historically, you've appeared regularly before the Senate Judiciary Committee for oversight of your activities as Attorney General. At this point, the Attorney General of the United States refused our request to have him come and appear before us. He said instead he would go to the Intelligence Committee and then, as you saw, refused to answer a lot of questions. If you can't have a dialogue with a member of the cabinet, the top law enforcement authority in this land, because he's refusing to answer questions, it really compromises his ability to lead. And I, for one, just wonder, you recuse yourself from a Russian investigation, you dismiss the director of the FBI, you refuse to answer the questions of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Listen, this just happened within the first 5 months of this administration. I mean, usually no president faces anything like this in his entire tenure.
Are you suggesting that he resign?
I'm just saying that unless he's willing to be more cooperative and open with Congress, it's going to be difficult to have a working relationship. And it's necessary under our Constitution for both branches of government, in fact, all three branches of government, to function together.
Senator, I can't imagine what this week has been like for you in Washington. I know here in Illinois, just hearing all of these events, it's been this whirlwind. It's been really tough. And I wonder, we've been asking people on social media what comes next, in particular in regards to yesterday's shooting. But I can't help but think of the conversation you and I have just had in these few minutes about all of these things. And I wonder, when you think about what comes next for us, for the people of Illinois, for this country, what's your message to everyone today?
Well, your listeners probably know I've been doing this for a while. People have been kind enough to let me represent the state and a congressional district before it. So I've seen a lot of events, and some were shattering, like 9/11, and others reaffirming so many times. Here's what it comes down to. I believe in the people of this country, and I'm not saying this like some idealist, but I do believe in the basic wisdom and common sense of the people of this nation. And secondly, I sincerely believe in this Constitution that has guided this nation for 220 years plus. The principles, the values in that Constitution are enduring, and they're going to survive any Congress, any president. So at the end of the day, I'm confident this nation will be good, will be strong, and will emerge from whatever the challenge may be.
And do you think that this will be a turning point for people in terms of tone in the way that we speak to each other, whether it's you all in Washington or just everybody, folks here in Illinois talking to their neighbors?
Hope springs eternal, and I hope this does. I've seen Gabby Gifford, the congresswoman from Arizona, who was terribly wounded and has been compromised in her life ever since. I thought that might be the moment. It wasn't. Maybe this one will be, because I think we all understand our vulnerability. If we don't bring the dialogue, the political dialogue in this country, down a few notches to a reasonable exchange of views and debate and compromise, shame on us. The American people want that to happen more than anything.
Senator Dick Durbin, Illinois Senior Senator. Senator, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Glad to be with you.
We're asking you what you think about this as well. Dina in Chicago tweets, if we didn't care when 26 grade school children were murdered, what makes people think anything will happen now? Paul in Urbana says that the roots of alienation run deep. Keep the tweets coming. Our handle's 21STShow. We're joined now by former Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. He served under the Obama administration, of course, was also a longtime Republican member of Congress representing Illinois' 18th congressional district. He's on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. Secretary LaHood, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good day.
I want to start by asking you, bipartisanship isn't just a word for you. It's a reflection of your career. It's even the title of your book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics. Where are we, Secretary LaHood, as a country right now in terms of our political divide?
We're at a turning point. Yesterday was a part of the turning point. And when you see the members of Congress come together in the House of Representatives and the speeches that have been delivered by the president, by the Speaker of the House, by the minority leader, by other members from Illinois and around the country, you know that it's a reflection that what happened yesterday should never be allowed to happen again, and unless the tone is changed, unless people really understand that their role is to articulate their point of view, but in a respectful way, in a civil way. If that happens, then I think we'll move forward in a way that reflects the country. The country certainly is not as divided as I think it appears from Washington, D.C. You know, there are people that go to work every day. They work with their fellow employees. They serve on church boards, school boards, city councils. They work together to improve their communities. And, you know, that's really what has made America a great country. The vision in D.C. Really, hopefully, will change after what happened tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, after what, you know, tomorrow, of course, tonight is the game yesterday.
Right.
I'm just thinking about, not only did you serve so many years in Congress, your son, of course, is now representing Illinois' 18th Congressional District, Peoria. Darren could have been on that field yesterday. He wasn't. Do you worry about his safety? Not just his, obviously, because he's your son, but other political leaders?
Well, it's not something that we sit around and worry about. We know that there's very good security at the Capitol. Thankfully, Steve Scalise's, Congressman Scalise's detail was at the ball field, or many more people would have been killed. When you take these kinds of positions as a member of Congress, you understand that there will be differences, but you hope that the differences will be played out during the debate on the House floor or the Senate floor or in town meetings, and that people don't resort to the most violent type of behavior to try and settle their differences.
I wonder, when you think about that, there are people who point to recent years. Of course, Senator Durbin was mentioning Representative Gabby Giffords. We think about violence at Planned Parenthood clinics, shootings, churches. Black churches in particular, and they say yesterday is this trend towards political violence. We just have about a minute for a break, so I wonder if I can just get a yes or no from you right now, and we'll continue this conversation after that. Do you agree with that assessment, that this is a continuation of a trend toward political violence, what happened yesterday?
Well, I hope it's not a trend.
Yeah, okay. Well, we will continue this conversation. We're speaking and Ray LaHood. We're going to take a short break. After this conversation, we're going to keep speaking with him. We want to hear from you as well. We've got some Facebook comments we're going to get to. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. That's our handle, 21ST Show. As we talk about where do we go from here, when we talk about political rhetoric, the way that we speak to each other, the way that we act. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about bipartisanship. We're talking about political conversation. We're talking about the tone of things in our country after yesterday's violence in Washington, D.C. At a GOP congressional baseball game practice. My guest is former Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, longtime Illinois congressman, represented Illinois' 18th district in the House of Representatives from 1995 to 2009. Secretary LaHood, as we're talking about, you're saying you hope, obviously, this is not a trend towards political violence. Given that, what role do you think our lawmakers and current political leaders have to play right now?
They have to speak in a civil way, in a respectful way. They can express their differences, but in a way that reflects the important jobs that they have. And what I mean by that is that they don't trash another individual personally. They don't go on the attack. They stick to the issue. They express their point of view, and they do it in a way that reflects the important job that they have.
As someone who's been there in many capacities, what do you think needs to change? Let's start first in Washington in order to do what you just said, because as you said that, I can't help but think of everything else that's happened this week, of all of the hearings we've seen over the past couple of weeks. And I'm afraid we haven't really heard what you've just said. We've heard some expressions of people being respectful, but we've heard kind of the opposite as well.
Well, we have to have people in public office who respect the jobs that they have and understand that the jobs that they have, they can have opposing views with their colleagues, They can have spirited debates with their colleagues, but people must understand that there have to be some civil, respectful rules of engagement. And to me, that it's just common sense that people operate that way. And I go back to the folks in districts all over America that send these people to Washington D.C. as their representative in Congress. These are people who serve in their communities on school boards, church boards, library boards, city council, county boards. They have differences with their fellow citizens, but it always ends up with a respectful and civil feeling that even though we had our opposite opinions, and even though we had our disagreements, we're still friends, and we still need to work together. That's a reflection of America that should be carried out in Washington, D.C.
That's former Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood on the line from Washington, D.C. Secretary, thanks for time. Thank you for taking the time to be
thank
with us.
You
I
very
appreciate
much.
It.
Have a good day.
You too. You know, as we're hearing former Secretary LaHood talk about that civil tone, we've been asking you after yesterday's congressional hearing, where do we go from here? We've been hearing from our listeners on social media. Everyone has been very civil, but I must say many of our messages were partisan when we asked folks. They were about the NRA or specific lawmakers. We got a Facebook message from John who said, for example, I strongly condemn the senseless violence of the shooting of the GOP congressman. Maybe now the GOP will see the need for effective gun control legislation. Joining us to talk about political discourse is the director of the University of Illinois' Klein Center for Democracy, Scott Althaus. He also teaches science and communication at the university. He's with us from our Urbana studios. Scott, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
Scott, as you were listening to Secretary LaHood talk about how we have sort of this discourse in this country, right, where maybe we are together in churches or on boards, or maybe that discourse is civil. Would you say that's the case? Outside of that, where are we at with political rhetoric? And let's just not talk about leaders. Let's just talk about people now, just person to person. How does that compare to what we've seen in the past? Where are we?
Well, I think it is an important point that the discourse that we hear about on the news every day is largely emanating from Washington, D.C., and that's a particular type of discourse around a particular set of issues that may not reflect what's really going on at the local level around the country. So I think Secretary LaHood has a good point there, that democracy moves on in ways that seem to work pretty well at lower levels. But what's new here today is not the negativity or the extremism of the discourse. In fact, in many ways, it's true what Senator Durbin said, that political language has become coarser, more violent, more confrontational. That's true if we compare today's discourse to the last five decades or so. But if we go further back in time, we very quickly re-enter an era where this type of discourse was pretty common in the United States.
Right. I mean, you think about former presidents like Abraham Lincoln and the things he was called. I know that they were pretty awful things that happened. But, Scott, I have to think about the level when we think about we don't know. I'm thinking about yesterday's events. Obviously, the investigation is ongoing. What we can tell from the alleged shooter, the way he presented himself on social media, he was a longtime critic of Republicans. He belonged to a Facebook group called Terminate the Republican Party. Obviously, during Abraham Lincoln's time, we did not have social media to kind of for people to stir each other up. There were, though, I think, lots of partisan news outlets. How has social media and our news outlets changed the way people get involved in political movements today, Scott?
Well, social media has done four things that have really changed the environment in which this kind of communication takes place. The first is social media has made it a lot easier for people to discover other people who share particular views. Social media has also helped to organize like-minded people for action, to reach people who are geographically dispersed. So if you go back to the 1980s, if you wanted to develop an extremist communication service, you'd have to do that through the Postal Service with stamps on envelopes, and it would take a long time to find and reach those people. But one of the most important things that social media has done today is to continuously feed this geographically dispersed, like-minded set of people with fresh content in real time. And I think it's the velocity and it's the volume of that fresh content that is something that is very unprecedented in American history.
We just got a Facebook comment from Bobby. The president needs to lead. He needs to stop making ad hominem derogatory statements. He sets the tone. Scott, I wonder if you feel like we are in a different place now, given what we've heard from the tone that we've heard from the language of the president of the United States, whether it's in his tweets or what he's saying in news conferences or the way he interacts with journalists.
We have definitely entered some unfamiliar territory in the way that our top leaders in the country are communicating, and President Trump is no exception to that. And there is an important role for leadership to set the tone of what disagreement is going to look like and what are the boundaries of acceptable discourse as we move forward politically. You know, there's a long history in this country of resorting to the ballot box rather than other means that are more common around the world when people get frustrated and feel that they don't have a voice in the governance of their country. We're not heading in that direction, but we're certainly moving in a direction that raises new concerns about how this new level of intensity in our discourse that's being set by not only political leadership, but I think more importantly, media leadership and social media leadership that are outside the conventional institutions of government, how that is creating an environment that probably reduces the margin for people like this man who committed this horrible act yesterday to move to action. And that I think is the question we need to be asking ourselves.
When you say that, Scott, when we think about, as you're saying, outside the traditional sort of what news media or other outlets, and we think about those bubbles, right, that we're in, we've all heard about these bubbles, whether it's through our social media or through our news outlets. You know, I just wonder, as you think about that, how do we work to overcome those divisions? Because you said, you know, people may have the perception that things are not working as well as they are, or people may feel that things are not working as well as they are. Some of that may be their actual economic reality. Some of that may not be. And it may be, as you said, sort of fomented by these bubbles. How do we overcome that? I'm curious about that as a political scientist, how you think we overcome that.
Well, I think we have to first understand what is at the root of what's behind this disagreement. If we look back to the presidential campaign from last year, we see that the causes that are showing up in Bernie Sanders' campaign and what is motivating people to attend his rallies are not altogether different from what we saw for people attending the Trump rallies. There's a great deal of frustration in this country about the standard way that federal governments have been going about doing their business. And until we understand where is that frustration coming from, how is it that our governing institutions are not being sufficiently responsive to large segments of our population, both on the political left and on the political right, that are giving rise to this anger and the set of concerns that we're talking about today, it's going to be difficult to really understand how we can manage the discourse part that we're talking about. There's an institutional story here that we have to get to the bottom of, and I don't think we yet understand why we're facing, not just in the United States, but across the Western world, similar kinds of tensions, and populism is on the rise, and it's just not clear what's undergirding that.
That's Scott Althaus. He's the director of the Klein Center for Democracy. He also teaches political science and communication at the University of Illinois. Scott, certainly lots more for you political scientists to try to get to the bottom of, I imagine. I know you'll be working on that, and you can come back. When you have an answer for that, why don't you come back and talk to us about that?
Okay.
Thanks so much for joining us. Let's end on a comment from one of our listeners, an email we got from Jane in Dixon, Illinois. Jane says, "While civil discussion is a necessary part of working together, it can't stop there. We can talk all we want, but if everybody doesn't actually get respect for their need, their view and need, and receive something in the end, such as supporting legislation, then civil discourse is hollow." Thanks, Scott. Thanks to everyone who tweeted, who left us voicemails and posted on our Facebook page. And you can keep the conversation going, especially on our Facebook page. Thanks so much. You're listening to The 21st. to more local politics, closer to home, we know that Illinois has been without a budget for 715 days. So far, the big question has been, will anything move our lawmakers and governor to work together to pass a budget? Well, one appellate court hearing in southern Illinois over state worker pay might be it. Someone who's been covering all of those hearings is IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. He's on the line with us now from southern Illinois. Brian, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, good to talk to you. From Springfield, back home in Springfield.
Oh, you're back in Springfield. Actually. Sorry, I knew you were in southern Illinois yesterday. Okay, you're all over the state. Like, how important is this case, Brian, this state worker pay case?
It's pretty important. It's the thing that's kept Illinois government from shutting down. And as of, I think, February, when there was a prior court hearing here, the Attorney General's office threw out the number $3 billion in state money had been expended, not through the normal process where the legislature passes a bill to appropriate it and the governor signs it, but instead through a single judge's order. So what was happening earlier this week on Tuesday in Mount Vernon, the 5th District Appellate Court, they were hearing an appeal of that decision. Attorney General Lisa Madigan is saying that's unconstitutional. If state employees need to be paid, it needs to go through the regular legislative process. Only the legislature has the power to appropriate money for state employee pay or anything else that Illinois government spends money on.
And how are employees being paid now then?
So they're being paid through this court order. They're getting their regular paychecks through the controller's office the way they always do.
And what is Attorney General Lisa Madigan's argument then?
So her basic argument is that the Constitution has a clause that says the General Assembly shall make appropriations. And this actually goes back, I guess, to English common law, where you didn't want the king writing checks that the parliament or whatever the legislative body would then have to, you know, to have to decide whether to cash. And so if the king just had unlimited power to write checks, then he could force the expenditure of money. They didn't want that. You want to have the legislature have the power to say, okay, this is how much money we have. This is how much we can spend. Now go and run government with the amount of money we said you can use. This is what some people often refer to as part of the autopilot spending. Illinois, even though we haven't had a budget for almost 2 years now, we're spending more money than we probably at this point, more money than we did when we had a budget, because there are so many court orders and automatic payments that are making the money go out of our accounts.
And what would it mean for the budget situation, Brian, if the court rules that state employees can't be paid during an impasse?
That's the big question. A couple of years ago, I think it would have meant a shutdown of Illinois government, right? We've seen in Washington when the government shuts down, you know, people who work for every federal agency outside of maybe, you know, the prisons and the FBI, things like that, are sent home. Things close down. Government offices close down. You can't access any government services, Social Security, things like that. And in Illinois, we've never really had that. If you are sort of an everyday person in Illinois, you don't think, at least, that you rely on government services. Maybe you don't have anyone in college. You don't have any special needs people in your family or anything like that. It doesn't look like state government is really in that much of a crisis to you. You can still get your driver's license renewed. You can still get your hunting license, fishing license, things like that. And what this would do is it would probably force a real shutdown of Illinois government, where probably the prisons would remain staffed. And you imagine the state police, they'd find some way to keep them on the roads, some basic core emergency services. But the rest of Illinois government, which maybe people don't realize how it affects them every day, but it does, that would actually shut down. And there was some thought a couple of years ago that maybe that would force legislators to come together, solve the budget crisis. Nowadays, though, with everybody so quick to blame each other, I'm not even sure that we wouldn't just get another round of finger pointing rather than any sort of forced compromise.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. We're going to continue this conversation with Brian Mackey. Illinois Social Service Agencies were also back in court this morning. There's a report from Politico that Governor Rauner is going to call a special session starting next week to resolve this budget impasse. Stay tuned. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Brian Mackey's going to be with me here after the short break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If there was a theme this hour, it would be bipartisanship. We've been talking about politicians, whether or not they can work together, whether that's in Washington or here in Illinois. We know the case. They have not been doing that in Illinois because we've been without a budget for 715 days. We're talking to IPR's Brian Mackey about this. We've been talking about an appellate court case over state worker pay. Brian, when are we expected to hear about that?
There's really no timeline on when the appellate court might rule in this case, so don't know. And even if whichever way that ruling goes, I think it's not likely to necessarily have an immediate effect. There's a lot of qualifiers in that sense. Let me say that again. I don't think it will probably have an immediate effect because one or the other. And I got to say, there is a strange aspect to this case. On the one side, you have Attorney General Lisa Madigan. On the other side, you have AFSCME and the Rauner administration, which both say they want to see state employees get paid. Pretty strange bedfellows. Somebody tweeted at me when I noted that, because the Rauner administration and AFSCME are at war on their contract and other things. But basically, either of those sides is likely to appeal if they lose. And then this was only a preliminary ruling from the trial court. So in order to really resolve it, you could see where they could say, well, send it back to the trial court, do a full trial. That means evidence, discovery, presentation.
Lots of time.
Jury could potentially be involved. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Time. Exactly.
Illinois social service agencies were also back in court this morning as well. Brian, what were they asking for?
Yeah, they were in St. Clair County Court, and this was yesterday, and they said that they basically are asking to get treated the same way that state employees have. In fact, it was before the very same St. Clair County judge who issued that ruling. There's only, I guess, one chancery judge in St. Clair County. This is a group of social service providers. They deal with homeless teenagers, people with addiction, domestic violence victims, women who have been sexually assaulted, and they have not, the state has contracts with these people. They point out, we are not charities. We are businesses. The state decided to outsource these functions. They used to do them in-house. Now they outsource them. We have contracted with the state to do these things, and we are not getting paid. And they say that, you know, the governor has violated his constitutional authority by entering into these contracts and then going ahead and vetoing some of the bills that the legislature has passed to him to actually pay for them. He says they're unbalanced and, you know, not part of the overall deal he wants to see. But that's the argument they're using. The state says, no, you cannot have the courts continuing to force the state to spend money like it has in so many other cases. But, you know, that is, the attorney general is once again opposing this case. This could, if it, you know, again, these things take a lot of time to work themselves out. There's actually an appellate court opinion that was expected. Last time I looked this morning, it had not been published, but I haven't hit refresh on that page that was in a similar case.
So it sounds like,
Brian, lots of things
unresolved there. We just have about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you very quickly about Politico reporting this morning. Governor Rauner is going to call a special session starting next week, lasting every day until June 30th, which would, of course, would be one day before Illinois ends its third year without a budget. Does it look like that's going to happen? Would we see a budget proposal? We just got about 30 seconds to answer that.
Yeah, I guess the real answer is I don't know. I do think it's notable here that, you know, the Republicans have come out with what they call a compromise. We've heard Democrats throw the word we passed their compromise plan. You know, it's a compromise when both parties show up at the news conference together, and that hasn't happened yet. I'll be waiting for that to happen before I start making any summer vacation plans.
It's IPR's State House reporter Brian Mackey, who will not be making summer vacation plans until there is a budget resolution. Brian, thanks as always for being with us. I appreciate it.
Good to talk with you, Nyla.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Animals we know are curious creatures, especially pets like to roam around, sniff new scents, nibble on grasses. And unless you're an expert on poisonous plants, like members of the University of Illinois' Poisonous Plant Garden, it can be hard to spot what poses a risk to your pet, especially this summer as everyone's enjoying being outside. Fortunately, we have someone who knows all about this. Michael Beal is a clinical professor of toxicology at the University of Illinois. He's joining us to talk about poisonous plants before a weed field day event at the University of Illinois. For folks who are in the Champaign-Urbana area, there's an event at, from 5:30 to 7 o'clock this evening for you to join to talk about that. We'll tweet out the information about that. Professor Beal, thanks for being with me. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I imagine people don't, I think pet owners are always a little cautious, right? Especially dog owners about what kind of things their dogs are eating. When you're sort of on the lookout, are there specific things in Illinois that, or and I wonder, I imagine it's different for different animals. What's poisonous for, say, a cow versus a cat in terms of grasses or other plants?
It's not so much difference between what's poisonous, but it's more what they have access to. Of course, you know, cow's not going to be in the house and worry about house plants where your cat and your dog that's left alone for a long period of time, they get bored, they get curious, and they may start getting into things. But there's certain species specificities with regard to plants and toxicity, but for general, they're pretty common across mammals.
Okay, let's start with house plants in particular. What kind of house plants might be poisonous to? And I guess we're going to focus on dogs and cats, really, right?
The National Animal Poison Control Center is here in Champaign-Urbana, and they're a veterinary poison control center. And some of the things they see the most commonly, of course, there's plants such as Diefenbachia, Philodendron, and such that have something called insoluble calcium oxalates. They're like little crystals, and they're the plant's defense mechanism. So if an animal or a child bites into those plants, it's just like it's been described as eating ground glass. So it's very, very irritating to the mouth. Believe it or not, one of the most common calls they're getting with regard to plants anymore is marijuana. And oftentimes in food products that people place marijuana into, and dogs eat the whole pan of brownies, et cetera.
Oh, no.
And,
what happens?
Well, it's a varied thing. Not to mention the chocolate can be a big problem for dogs, as many people are aware. But you see different things in the sense of, since they may get very excitable at first and then get more depressed, just as you might expect. One thing that's characteristic with dogs that have been exposed to marijuana is they will dribble urine for whatever reason. And then I always tell the students they have an incredible craving for Doritos afterwards. But other than that,
that's not true. That's very funny.
No,
I shouldn't laugh. That's
not
I'm
actual,
sure
of course.
It could be. I'm sure I shouldn't laugh because I'm sure that people whose dogs have been in this situation do not find it funny.
No, but it always gets a laugh out of the students, so I throw it in. And then one thing that's really become a big issue, and I do want to point out, is a plant called sago palm. These are very common in the South. They grow very large near doorways
sure.
and
yeah,
stuff.
I was going to say, I'm from Florida, and in Miami, you find sago palms everywhere.
Yeah, they don't survive our winters, but what has happened is people, you know, horticulturists and stuff have created miniature indoor versions of them, and they've become very popular for home indoor plants. The only problem is if dogs do consume those, especially the center betel nut, they're incredibly liver toxic. They will just almost destroy a dog's liver, and they get a lot of calls on that through the Poison Control Center of dogs consuming sago palms, which either get very ill or even die.
Is it particularly dogs that we need to be worried about eating things? Is this not a cat issue when you're talking about house plants?
Again, it's the nature of the beast. You know, a Labrador is going to eat anything. Cats are much more finicky. They don't get into things. The one thing that we do really focus on with cats that a lot of cat owners are aware of are lilies and specific types of lilies. One of the things students say they're going to put on my grave is a lily is not a lily is not a lily, because there's different types. But Easter lilies and day lilies specifically, when cats get exposed to them, very quickly, within 24 hours, they can go into acute renal failure. It attacks their kidneys. We don't know for sure what it is that's doing it, what the toxin is. But it damages cells within the kidney and eventually causes the kidneys to get plugged up. And this can happen very quickly. If you think your cat has been exposed to day lilies or Easter lilies, you need to get them to a veterinarian right away. But, and this is where the confusion comes in, other types of lilies like peace lilies and calla lilies, they have those insoluble calcium oxalates I mentioned earlier that are like the ground glass. So that's the oral lesions, and those are across species. The renal issues with eastern daylilies are cats only. And then we have Lily of the Valley that would have the pretty little white flowers that are, you know, ground cover. They're totally different. They have a toxin in it that attacks the heart. So just because it has lily in it doesn't mean it's going to, in the name, doesn't mean it's going to be a problem in cats. A lot of owners get that confused. I always tell the students, they're the veterinarian, they're supposed to, they got to know the difference between the different types of lilies.
We're talking about plants that are toxic to your pets. We've been talking about indoor plants so far. My guest is Professor Michael Beal. He's a clinical professor of toxicology at the University of Illinois. Professor Beal, what about outside? What kind of plants do we need to be thinking about for outside that are poisonous particularly? And again, I'm going to go with probably, well, some people have cats that are both indoor and outdoor, but this is, I imagine, also more of a dog issue.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I'll have to say that most of your plants, foundation plants around the house and such like that, of course, you know, your daylilies, as I mentioned already, for cats are going to be outside. But most of these plants, I mean, azaleas, rhododendrons, they have cardiotoxins in them, but animals aren't going to consume that much. I mean, they're not going to probably bite enough that it's going to be an issue. Now, the one exception to that is oleander, which is, you know, it's a beautiful plant, grows extensively mm-hmm. in the South. That is one of the most potent, more toxic plants we know. One leaf basically would probably kill a child or kill a dog or small dog. So, again, they're probably not going to be eating on that, but if you have oleander in your garden, that's one you want to make sure you keep your animals, your dog, away from, because it is a very potent cardiotoxin. That's just one example.
So I had a question for you about livestock, mm-hmm. Not necessarily plants, but perhaps eating poisonous weeds. How much of a problem is that?
It's definitely a problem. It's seasonal in the sense that there's a lot of, you know, pastures have a lot of weeds. But, you know, May and this time of year when there's a lot of rain and the grass is very plentiful and, you know, knee high or higher, they're going to focus on the grass. They're not going to eat the weeds. Later on in the summer, August, when it gets hot and dry and the grass is not as plentiful, they're going to eat anything that's green. And oftentimes weeds tend to stick around more. One thing that's very common in the Midwest that is a problem is white snake root, which is a very common weed. It needs a little shade, so it tends to grow in wooded pastures or on the edge. Horses are incredibly sensitive to that. It's, again, a cardiotoxin. It damages the heart, causes necrosis and damage in the heart, and they're very sensitive to it, not as much as cattle. Of course, the most important thing really from the standpoint of consuming plants in the Midwest is what we call mycotoxins. This is fungus that grows on grain, such as everybody's heard of aflatoxin. And there's other types of mycotoxins, so they're metabolites of the fungus that are toxic to mammals when consumed.
Professor Beal, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you about some of the myths regarding plants. Would that, if you could maybe educate us on for a minute?
Well, the most important one, poinsettias are not inherently toxic. I know there's the old wives' tale out there that they're incredibly toxic. That was based on a misidentification of a plant years and years ago. They have something in them called saponins, which are a soap-like material. So if an animal eats a lot, they're going to salivate. They might vomit a little bit, have a little GI upset, but they're not. It's not fatal. They're not. So if you have cats or dogs in the house, buy all the poinsettias at Christmas time that you want. The other thing that we always tell the students, you're going to be asked this in practice. Everybody knows what Japanese yews are, and they have those little red berries. And they always ask, are the berries toxic? My child just ate them. My dog ate them. The berry is the only part of that plant that isn't toxic. The seed inside the berry is toxic, but there's not enough there to be an issue. The rest of that plant, the green parts, are incredibly toxic. Again, a heart issue, but the berries are not. And then, as I mentioned, what we usually oftentimes see a lot of confusion with owners and such are the different lilies. Some of them cause the renal problem in cats. Some of them don't. So it's very important to understand the differences between the plants. Just because it has, you know, part of a name in it doesn't mean they're all the same.
You can learn more about this if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area this evening. There's a College of Veterinary Medicine event. We'll tweet out some more resources as well for folks interested in this. I want to thank Professor Michael Beal. He's the clinical professor of toxicology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have the NPR One app and Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.